Well, good morning. We have a full house here today, it looks like. My notes tell me that we may have students from Palmyra Eagle High School, and if that's the case, would they and their teacher please stand? Very good. Thank you. You may be seated. The students are here on a program that the Supreme Court operates in conjunction with the State Bar of Wisconsin called Court with Class, and they get some materials about the case that's going to be argued by you all in a few minutes. And after the conclusion of the argument, Justice Michael Gableman will come and speak to all of the students, not about the substance of the case, but tell you a bit more about how cases get to the Supreme Court, what our procedures are, and so forth. And anybody that cares to stay and listen to Justice Gableman, please, you are all invited to do so. I'd like to introduce the court to all those present, beginning on my far right, Justice Rebecca Bradley. Next to her, Justice Annette Ziegler. On my right, Justice Shirley Abrahamson. I am Pat Rogensack, the Chief Justice. On my left, Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. Next to her, Justice Michael Gableman. And on the far end of the bench, Justice Daniel Kelly. So, with those introductions, I will call our second case, Overton versus Lurk. Are you ready to proceed, counsel?
Yes, ma'am.
Please do.
This is my colleague, Bronwyn Baldwin. I am William Sherlin Sample. We are on staff at State of Wisconsin Labor and Industry Review Commission. Thank you, Madam Chief Justice. May it please the court. The issue in this case is the proper standard of review of the commission's conclusions of law in substantial fault cases. There's also whether the legislature, when it enacted the substantial fault law, at the same time overruled the Boynton Cab misconduct standard this court enunciated almost 80 years ago, and along with it the history of interpretation of that definition, or whether instead the legislature codified that definition, bringing with it the rich history of interpretation of it. We believe it was the latter, and that because the legislature did so, the commission's conclusions of law in both misconduct and substantial fault cases may receive great weight deference from reviewing courts.
Well, even if we disagree with you about the codification of Boynton, wouldn't you argue it should have great weight deference?
We would, but the Court of Appeals did not agree.
Well, who cares? We're here reviewing them.
Well, we understand that this court is reviewing the agency's decision, but we also know that this court looks to the reasoning and decisions of the lower courts to aid them. So
that's
we wanted
right.
to get that in.
Okay. But you think you could win even without Boynton being codified? That your position is you're entitled to great weight deference even if we would disagree as to whether Boynton was codified?
Oh, yes, Your Honor.
That's all I'm trying to get to. So the real issue here is deference.
It's one of the key issues, yes.
Yeah, it's not the only issue, certainly, before us.
No, it is not.
We have a statute that we have never spoken to before, and I, for one, like to be sure that I can inform folks that have to use the statute subsequent to our decision what it means and what they're expected to look for as it's being applied.
And then determines whether we use your interpretation or will we use a different interpretation. That goes to deference, right?
It does go to deference, and I do have remarks about the meaning of the statute and in conjunction with our interpretation of it.
Can I direct your thoughts just a little bit to answer a question that I have? It relates to the statute, and it relates to what is or isn't an inadvertent error.
Well, I believe there is consensus that inadvertent means unintentional. So
inadvertent means what?
Unintentional. So we believe an inadvertent error is an unintentional error.
Okay, I want to go a little further with that. Why is it unintentional?
That's unintentional is the common theme running through the definitions of inadvertent that we are aware of.
Okay, well, there's something that I review Lurch's decision. Okay, that's what I'm looking at. So I'm looking at the final page of the ALJ decision that the Lurch adopted as its own. And I draw your attention to the ALJ's interpretation of the three exceptions, three things that are not substantial fault. So that's what I'm looking at. And the ALJ considered them seriatim. So first he talked about the first one, then he talked about the second one, and then he talked about the third one. Justice Ziegler's question refers to the second type of an act by an employee that does not fall within substantial fault. And if you look at the second to the last, third to the last sentence, I guess it is, the ALJ says she was aware of the employer's policies, including the cash handling and the WIC check procedure, but continued to make cash handling errors resulting in actual financial loss to the employer after receiving multiple warnings. Now, when I read that and I try to line it up with inadvertent errors, what the ALJ says is, well, she was aware of the policy. So maybe inadvertent includes a lack of awareness of the policy. You say unintentional, that's broad enough certainly to cover a lack of awareness. But when the ALJ wrote this, awareness was the test that he used to say that this wasn't an inadvertent error. So I'd like you to comment on that. Am I reading his statement wrong? Am I reading his statement correctly? What do you think?
Well, our position is that awareness of the requirement or the rule is something that goes to the reasonableness of the requirement. It's not, you wouldn't expect an employee to be required to follow something the employee didn't know he or she had to follow. So we don't believe the employee's awareness or unawareness of the rule goes to the second exclusion. It goes to reasonableness of the requirement.
Well, how does that, so you think it goes to whether or not the employer could say, you have to be careful and we have these policies about how we cash checks, about how we use credit cards, so you don't make errors. So you're saying awareness goes to whether the employer can have such a policy?
It goes to the reasonableness of the application of the policy to the acts or omissions in question. I don't believe there's a dispute over what I'm about to say, which is an employee is not going to be guilty of violating a reasonable requirement of the employer if the employee doesn't know of the requirement.
Okay, well, and that's what I was asking you about. Is that what the ALJ is saying when seriatim, he's reviewing the things that are not sufficient to show substantial fault? I mean, maybe I'm just giving you something to think about that you hadn't, but I've been chewing on this for quite a while since you filed all your briefs and opposing counsel did, and I'm trying to figure out for myself, what do I think the statute is?
Where does the decision address whether this is an inadvertent error or not?
We did not make an express finding that Ms. Overton's failures were not inadvertent errors, but as we argued in our reply brief, relying on Gallenberg, our failure to make an express finding that they were not inadvertent errors is to be construed as a finding that they were not inadvertent errors.
Well, counsel, on that point,
your answer to Justice Ziegler assumes it's a factual finding. why isn't inadvertent errors a conclusion of law based on the facts, the historic facts?
Because as we have interpreted inadvertent to mean unintentional, that is a matter of fact, not a matter of law. A person's intent in doing something is a factual matter that the reviewing statutes leave to the commission to decide.
Counsel, on this point, I'd like to turn that back into a discussion on the amount of deference due to the commission's decision. The commission adopted the ALJ's findings of fact and conclusions of law. So essentially what you're asking for us to do is to give great weight deference to the ALJ's decision. Is that correct?
No, that is not correct. I'm sorry, Your Honor. The commission acts under its own powers in an appellate capacity, and when it adopts the findings and conclusions of an appeal tribunal, it is taking them as its own, and it is the commission, they become the commission's findings and conclusions, and it is those findings and conclusions that the commission has taken as its own.
All right, so
that the reviewing court reviews.
If we're going to give great weight deference, we do it because of, in part, the commission's experience in construing the relevant provisions in question, and making sure that they are uniform and so on, right? That's the basis for great weight deference. So where in the commission's decision do we find an exercise of a specialized knowledge and expertise and background and only the things that justify great weight deference to its decisions?
Well, the commission's decision, first we noted that the employer has rules governing the conduct at issue. We described Overton's series of failures that led to the discharge and the disciplinary warnings she received. We noted that they were not done in intentional disregard of the employer's interests. We noted that the employer's cash handling policies are reasonable and indicated a reason why, to save, prevent monetary loss. We did not find that her failures were unintentional, and we noted that the record did not establish that she did not have the skill to perform the tasks at issue. And only after all that did we come to the determination that she was guilty of substantial fault.
What we're reviewing here is two pages, right? First page says we adopt what the ALJ said. Second page has some references to the $400 credit card transaction being a major infraction. Right? I mean, this is what we're reviewing. The substantial fault is a brand new provision in the unemployment benefit statute. So what I'm looking for is some evidence in these two pages that the commission has a great deal of experience, as you've alleged in your briefs, 80 years of experience, in construing this kind of provision. So where do I find that in these two pages?
You don't find it necessarily only in those two pages, but you would also look to the pages of the appeal tribunal decision, which has the findings and conclusions that the commission adopted, and you would look at the factors we went through in the elements of the substantial fault statute that we addressed in order to come to the conclusion of substantial fault.
All right,
and
so we're back to the ALJ's
as adopted by us, yes.
Okay. In I don't necessarily have a problem with that, but then are you saying that the ALJ has all of that relevant background and experience and expertise?
They might not, but whether they do or not is not relevant to for our purposes, because if we do not believe the appeal tribunal decision is correct, we will modify it or reverse it.
Right, but this is the first time this provision is coming before this court.
Yes.
All right. So I think it's reasonable for us to say, all right, show us your expertise in construing a substantial fault standard. Or are you telling me we just have to take that on faith?
Definitely not on faith, Your Honor. We are basing our argument on expertise on the fact that the same factors we analyze in a substantial fault case, such as control over the acts in question, the reasonableness of the employer's rule, whether it's a minor matter, whether it's unintentional, these are the exact same factors that we have been analyzing in misconduct cases since this court enunciated the standard in 1941.
Okay.
And so that's that our argument is that that expertise, the expertise we have in examining the factors in misconduct cases, goes to our analysis of the same factors in the substantial fault context.
All right. So in the substantial fault context, we have this concept of inadvertent errors, right?
Yes.
Okay. Under the misconduct standard, you have unintentional. Different words.
Well, if you look at Boynton Cab, at the bottom of page 258, the court talks about minor and casual or unintentional carelessness or negligence. But and then if you go over to the top of page 260, they're talking about inadvertencies or ordinary negligence in isolated instances. So this court itself does not consider those two terms to have a very different meaning based on that reading. Also,
those two terms, I'm sorry, but
inadvertent and unintentional.
Okay, thank you. I just needed.
And there's also the department's proposal. They indicate early on that the exclusion is going to unintentional failures, and then when they actually have the draft of the language, it's inadvertent errors.
Okay. So let's say that we graft that experience with unintentional onto inadvertent. Then isn't the gist of your argument that repeated inadvertent errors become intentional?
I want to read what we think on that because I've got to get it right.
Then read it slowly, because I want to take it
down. This goes to our interpretation of the substantial fault.
Tell us what
statute.
You're
going to
read from before you begin.
We're discussing inadvertent errors.
Gotcha.
When an employee is informed of conduct that is resulting in errors, and the employee keeps engaging in that conduct and committing the errors are not inadvertent because the employee has made a mindful decision to keep engaging in the conduct that is resulting in the errors. So,
isn't that definition fall into the very problem that the Court of Appeals said? That is, that definition requires some kind of forewarning. And the Court of Appeals said that your interpretation of sub 2, inadvertent errors, merges sub 1 with sub 2. Sub 1 requires inadvertent errors. Excuse me. Sub 1 requires forewarning and sub 2 doesn't. If I recall, that's what the Court of Appeals said, and in your definition started out when an employee is informed, right?
Yes, Your Honor. We believe that after a certain length of time in a series of errors and warnings regarding the failures at issue, the employee may no longer claim that the failures are still inadvertent.
Well, why is the Court of Appeals rationale wrong in saying, hey, sub 2 doesn't require forewarning, sub 1 does, and what you're doing is merging the two?
paragraph 24 of the Court of Appeals opinion makes that point that the ALJ and LIRC erred in merging the warning component set forth in the infraction exception, which is sub 1, with the inadvertent error exception in sub 2. So respond to, tell me why the Court of Appeals was wrong in that assertion. That you're, explain to me how you're not merging the warning in sub 1, which requires infraction, with sub 2, which doesn't mention anything about warning.
What we are saying is that with each successive failure and warning, the employee may no longer credibly, it may be the case that the employee's continuing claims of inadvertence are not credible. And that doesn't conflate the two exclusions. It just uses the fact that the employee keeps getting warned about the conduct in question to come to some kind of determination with regard to the employee's intent in the continuing series of failures.
What, if any, import should we give to the finding regarding intent when LIRC addresses misconduct? And if I recall, that finding is that the applicant here did not intentionally, and I'm reading from what page? It's in the finding the facts section. It's in probably about the fifth page of the report.
I believe it's 44, Your Honor.
Well, that I have from the record, it doesn't have the page, so that's why I'm swimming here a little bit. But it says this, in the findings of fact. In this case, there's no evidence that the employee intentionally or willfully disregarded the employer's interest by continuing to make cash handling errors. What import, if any, on the issue of intent do we garner from that statement as we try to deal with intent under sub 2?
Well, the misconduct definition is such willful or wanton disregard of the employer's interests as is found in deliberate violation or disregard. And what the finding that you just read is a finding that the employee did not have that wrongful purpose when committing the act.
Well, it doesn't say that, though. I mean, I'm familiar with the language. We see it a lot. I hear it a lot. Willful and wanton disregard. That's not what this says. That the employee, there's no evidence that the employee intentionally, you know, we're talking about intent here. And so I find that potentially significant. It isn't just willful, wanton disregard that we see all the time. The employee didn't intentionally. And I assume when you say the employee didn't intentionally, that's tantamount to saying it was unintentional.
We disagree, Your Honor.
Okay, so convince me that not intentional is different than unintentional.
This goes to the individual's motives, state of mind when committing the failures in question. If Ms. Overton, when not checking the customer's credit card, had it in her mind, I know this rule and I know I'm supposed to follow it, but I'm not going to follow it. I'm intentionally not going to follow it. That is the deliberate disregard of the employer's interests. Her act was done in intentional disregard of the employer's interests. What we are saying is that finding cannot also require a finding that the act itself was unintentional, because if that were the case, the substantial fault law becomes a nullity.
But all you had to say there was willful and wanton disregard. You added something. You added the very thing that we're struggling with. What's the intent?
Well, there's the
I mean, I don't get that as a rhetorical question almost. We're struggling with what is the intent. And so you, that's
well,
added.
There,
that's
exactly right. The, you know, acts are done with varying degrees of intent. Misconduct requires a deliberate violation or disregard of the employer's standards. That is, when the employee commits the act, they have the
counsel,
employer standard.
I would like to ask something, that, and I've asked Justice Bradley if she minded if I jumped in here, because this is something that I'm trying to suss out, which is I understood Lurk's position to be that, in that one instance, that's an inadvertence, but it's because of the series, it's because of the number of them, as Justice Kelly was asking about, that in the briefs it says tantamount to, or is transformed, it doesn't matter, into an intent. Is that not correct? Or are you saying one act of accepting the check for $6.17, for instance, when the check from WIC was only good up to $6, and she testified that the customer gave the 17 cents in cash. Would that one transaction be enough to be intentional under your hypothetical, or is it the series of, I think there were about 8 transactions here or so?
It's the series. We acknowledged.
It's
the series? I'm
okay,
sorry.
So then my question is, at what point is it, it must be then a case-by-case analysis?
It is a case-by-case analysis, Your Honor. Every case has its own set of fact situations, and those different fact situations will lead to different results. And because of the different fact situations, the fact that different cases have different results does not make those cases inconsistent, and my red light is on.
Yeah, I have a question I'll give you now, but don't answer it. You think about it and answer it later. And it goes back to whether inadvertent error is a standard of law or an issue of fact. When you answered Justice Bradley's question, you said that when you have repetitive errors, then you fall outside of inadvertent. To me, what you said was these facts fulfill the standard of inadvertent. Standards are legal conclusions. So think about that. I may not have understood you clearly, but to me, what you said in answer to her was that inadvertent was a legal conclusion, and it was outside of the facts of this case. So you just think about that, and then you have 5 minutes when you come back for lots of other things, I'm sure.
Thank you. I did have some things that I needed to get to, and hopefully I will be able to do so in
very
rebuttal.
Good. Very good. Thank you. Well, that's just a suggestion. If you don't want to do it, that's okay with me.
Ignore it at your peril.
May it please the court, my name is Marilyn Townsend, and I'm here today with my co-counsel, Fred Wade. I am also pleased to be here today with Lila Oberton, who is observing these proceedings. During the time this morning, I observed the first argument, and I was struck by one of the comments that Chief Justice Rogan said, and that was, statutory words are always good. And I want to start today with the statute, because it is the statute that controls, in our belief, that Ms. Oberton should have been granted unemployment benefits. The purpose of unemployment benefits in Wisconsin is to help businesses, to help the community, and to help a worker who is suddenly discharged from her job with no visible means of support. In this case, the legislature clearly wanted to tighten up the the basis for granting unemployment. The legislature thought misconduct was too difficult to prove, and they thought that a lot of workers were getting unemployment who didn't deserve it. So they said, we are going to disallow those workers who are fired for substantial fault, in addition to misconduct, from getting unemployment. But the legislature understood that substantial fault is a broad concept, and they wanted to be sure that the agency that's charged with enforcing the law didn't disqualify hard-working, conscientious Wisconsin workers who were unable to meet the standards of their employer.
Well, let's look at how broad that concept of substantial is. Are we supposed to look at each error in isolation to determine whether it is inadvertence?
Justice Kelly, my answer to that is yes.
Okay. So for example, there one of the instances, if I recall, was that she had handed a WIC check back to the customer as the customer was leaving. Is that correct?
Correct.
So we look at that in isolation, we say, oops, that looks inadvertent. But what happens if she does that once a day?
Well, I've represented workers in unemployment for 30 years, and I would respectfully point out that the employer would terminate that employee very quickly if that employee did it once a day. In this case, Ms. Overton made 8 errors. The employer admitted that.
I don't want to miss the import of your answer here. So, would the employer be justified in saying there was substantial fault involved if the employee was doing that once a day?
Well, you look at the context and when it and how it occurred. Was the employee simply inattentive? The definition of inadvertent, the first word that comes up in many of the 5 dictionaries that your honors have been cited in our briefs, is inattentive. The second word is unintentional. The question is, was that employee inattentive? Was she making the kind of mistakes that any of us might make?
Right, so we can't look at it in isolation, right? Don't we have to look at that in relation to everything else that she did to determine whether it's inadvertent or something different?
I think that's correct.
Okay. So are you conceding then that the commission is correct that repeated inadvertencies can become intentional?
Yes, with a caveat. And that caveat is, in this case, the commission never addressed the issue that this was a conscientious employee who the employer believed was working to the best of her ability, came in always on time, and when the employer discharged her, offered her a reference. What we maintain is the agency should have looked at the entire picture, and it did not. It said at some point inadvertent errors, inattentive errors become substantial fault. It's our submission that not in the context of Lila Overton do they ever become substantial fault. And our quest today is really quite narrow. We ask this court to affirm the Court of Appeals decision that found that Lurk improperly denied Lila Overton, who Walgreens said was a conscientious employee working to the best of her ability. She was not the person that this substantial fault statute was designed for.
Is the term inadvertent errors as used as an exception to substantial fault a question of law, or is it a question of fact?
I agree with Lurk's counsel that it is a question of fact, okay, whether something was inadvertent.
So
You think it's a question of fact because you would look at them one by one. So each time she made a financial error, you would have to say, well, that was inadvertent. Okay, and I understand Lurk's position is you can only have so many inadvertencies, and then you're going to fall outside of inadvertent errors. But if it's not a standard of a legal standard that facts fulfill under the statute, then you can never get to the question I asked and come up with a legal standard. You always are one by one, and the first you have a first time every time, then it has to be a question of fact. But Lurk apparently used a progression of errors and said that this wasn't inadvertence. So in my view, what they said was a question of law. So how am I mixing up this interpretation?
Chief Justice Rogensack, I understand your question. The position is simply violating a rule, simply making a mistake, should not amount to substantial fault. What happened in this case is Lurk never did the inadvertent error analysis at the time the case was presented to them. It never looked at the eight errors and made a decision as to whether they were advertent or inadvertent. And instead, in the briefs it submitted to the court, it takes the position that we raised the issue for the first time in the circuit court, and it really wasn't before them. However, in their Campbell decision, which the Court of Appeals properly pointed out was inconsistent, they looked at the individual errors and said, are they advertent or inadvertent? They never did that with Ms. Overton.
Okay, well, what I was trying to figure out from Lurk's decision, which is what we review, not the Circuit Court or the Court of Appeals, except for the bottom line, I was trying to figure out what was Lurk saying in regard to this new statute, because I think the legislature made the statute. They had to have something in mind. They didn't just pull this out of thin air. And as Lurk goes through and addresses the three exceptions to substantial fault that are in the statute, quotes the statute, and then addresses them in a paragraph below, in regard to the second criteria, one or more inadvertent errors made by the employee, Lurk says she was aware of the employer's policies, including cash handling and the WIC check procedures, but continued to make handling errors resulting in actual financial loss to the employer after receiving multiple warnings. Why shouldn't I equate inadvertent with lack of awareness of the employer's policy or policies?
Well, I agree with Mr. Sample that that is not directed at the issue of inadvertencies.
Well, he must have been talking about something. He was analyzing the three exceptions.
What the hearing examiner did there, which often happens in these decisions, is repeated the statute, but then did not proceed to analyze it.
Well, if you look at the sentence that follows the one I read to you, now he's on to item number three. The record does not establish that the employee lacked the ability or skill to perform her work. As such, the appeal tribunal files that her discharge was, and then goes on to the conclusion.
Correct.
But the next sentence after the one I read to you analyzes the third exception. So it seems to me, as I'm reading it, he had a reason for saying this. First he quoted the statute, and then in language that was tied to your client, he talks.
Well, I understand your question, but it's our position, and it appears to also be the position of LIRC, that it never addressed the issue of inadvertent errors in the agency. And if you look at the case of Campbell...
Well, I don't think it's LIRC's position, well, that the agency never addressed it.
And if you look at the Campo decision, which was one of the decisions that the Court of Appeals said showed an inconsistency in application of the law, LIRC looked at each error, said this was inadvertent, this is why.
Well, they evaluated them one by one by one. That is absolutely true. Okay, so.
Counsel, you mentioned earlier in response to one of the Chief's questions, I think, if I understood you, I think it was her first question, you said that you agreed in general with the idea that there does come a point where a series of inadvertent mistakes does become, you agree with LIRC's position, that there is a point somewhere where a series of inadvertent mistakes does become tantamount to intent. But then you said that's not the case here.
With Justice Kelly, I indicated that the amount of errors are important to look at, but it's also important to look at the whole context of the situation. So just looking at the number of errors, no, I disagree. That in itself doesn't constitute a substantial fault.
Okay, so... Well, what I'm getting at is, and I understand, I mean, the record is very comprehensive here, and it paints a very vivid portrait, okay, of someone who, as you pointed out, even when she left, her manager offered to give her a letter of reference. At one point during her employment, she was homeless. Everyone agrees she was working to the best of her ability. The record shows that there were an estimated 80,000 transactions that she did, and there are 8 errors here. And in accepting the one for $399, the rest are pretty, well, they're not de minimis to the corporation because it adds up. But my point is, we're all concerned about the parties here. But I am equally concerned about all the parties yet to come who will be guided by our opinion. So what rule, setting aside the idea that your client wins, if you were given the opportunity to write the rule that emerges from this case, taking into account the idea that there does become a point, even if you view the whole situation holistically, what rule would you ask us to write as a result of this case?
What I would do if I were in your position, Justice Gableman, is I would write an opinion that focuses practitioners and LIRC on the word of inadvertent, which all 5 dictionaries say inattentive, unintentional, and then direct the agency to look at the whole facts.
You can't have a stock person stocking bottles of soda, it's like just missing the shelf, right, with glass bottles and just saying, whoops, you know, I just can't seem to make the shelf. I mean, that, right, on the first day, how many cases does the... Does the manager have to wait to fire the person? You know?
Well, the manager can fire him on the first stop.
I understand that without paying, though. That's the issue.
Right. But the purpose of, and this is pointed out in Boyd and Cab, the purpose of the unemployment benefits really did fall to benefit those unskilled workers.
Just because time is valued, you know, I don't want you to waste your time. I don't. Please link up the concept of there comes a point where inadvertence can become tantamount to to intent in your rule that you would have us articulate as a result of this case. That's all. And if you can't, you can't, and we'll move on. But that's, I just wanted to give you that opportunity.
Well, as I said to Justice Kelly, I do think it depends on the facts and circumstances. And I want to give Lurk credit for, in many situations, really being able to bring their values and do an application of it. I think if Lurk would focus on the fact that inadvertent means inattentive or unintentional, I think the decisions we practitioners have been getting would be more in accord with the statute that the legislature enacted, that only if you were engaged in substantial fault should you lose benefits, but one or more inadvertent errors do not meet that standard. And as a practical matter, even in this case, the employer gave Ms. Overton additional chances, and I would submit it did, because it understood she was always on time, she had a good attitude, and she was trying her best. So the other thing, employers do have the opportunity to hire, obviously, folks who have the qualifications and the attitude that fit the job. But as workers are looking for new jobs, this helps them.
What strikes me that we're not under the first subsection of infraction, right?
Correct.
All right. So what, and the Court of Appeals went through and said, well, we're not under that, so forget it. So we are under one or more inadvertent errors. And what the Court of Appeals, I'm trying to find what that means. We have to define what one or more inadvertent errors made by an employee means, because if you can get under two, you are not under substantial fault, right?
Correct.
All right. So the Court of Appeals in paragraph 25 says, one or more inadvertent errors, even if warnings are given, are not substantial fault, because warnings go into sub one, not two.
Correct.
And then it says the term inadvertent means failing to act carefully or considerately, inattentive, resulting from heedless actions, unintentional. And then it goes to the Campo case, and It goes to Kirkendall and said that the ALJ found there was no evidence of intentional or willful disregard, and that the findings of the ALJ reflect that Ms. Overton simply made types of unintentional mistakes that people make all the time. Now, she made eight errors here out of how many months that she worked?
20 months.
And how many transactions does she have?
Over 80,000, 200 a day, the manager said at the trial.
So we're dealing with eight, one or more, we're dealing with eight over, 20 months and
200 a day.
With a total of thousands.
Correct, 80,000.
All right. The findings of the ALJ, this I'm reading from the opinion, reflect that Overton simply made the type of unintentional mistakes that all people make at times. The legislature statutorily determined that an employee doesn't lose unemployment for making unintentional errors. And Walgreens argues that at some point, errors go beyond inadvertence and become intentional. And they say Walgreens and Lurk's argument here of a series of errors which taken individually are not disqualified at some point crossing over. And they say it's not in the statute. And therefore they say, nope, that what happens here is that her conduct reflects a failure and inability to conform rather than substantial fault. Now, isn't that your point?
I agree. That is our position.
So that you don't have an objection to their standard?
No, I do not.
Well, what about, I sort of like Judge Lundstrom's concurrence. What about you?
I thought Judge Lundstrom was very good as well. He said it didn't matter which level of review was given to Lurk.
Yeah, I'm just trying to get what the statute means, then we get to review. Which do you like better?
I like Judge Lundstrom's
decision. Good answer.
No. Do you prefer his approach? Do you think that makes more sense?
Well, I want to be sure I understand the question.
Okay. They approach the statute somewhat differently, I think. And the question is, do you? And if you think they approach the interpretation of the statute differently, which do you think is a better approach? This isn't really in response to Justice Gableman's question. If you were drafting this opinion, obviously you would draft it in favor of Ms. Overton. That's clear. But what would you say that covers both Ms. Overton and other cases that come up? So it's a guide to the ALJ and Lurk and other lawyers. Yeah, that's a hard question, and I know, because if I have to write the opinion, I need an answer.
I guess I would
I didn't
not
quite,
have anything
to add.
I didn't
quite put the hard sell on it like this, did I? But
yeah.
I'm happy to hear the answer, though. Thank you, Justice Abraham.
Yeah, right. Well, I don't have anything further to add on that. I
have
think,
a question that I hope will focus your answer. I'm trying to figure out how you interpret the law and why. And I'm looking at the second exception. And as I hear you saying, and if I'm wrong, please correct me, that the statutory definition of inadvertence has a temporal component so that it is implied, it is applied at the time of each individual error.
Well, I think as a practical matter in the law, that we determine what the facts are based on
I'm asking you for a definition of a term in a statute, okay? Repeat the question.
I apologize.
I'm not hearing you correctly, and that's why I'd like you to correct me. I hear you saying that the statutory definition of inadvertence has a temporal component, so that whether it's inadvertent is applied at the time the error is made.
Yes, that is what I'm saying.
Thank you. Counsel, at least I know I'm understanding.
Justice Abrahamson pointed out in the beginning of her most recent questioning to you, as she pointed out, we're under sub 2 here in the exceptions. But I look at sub 1 in regard to minor infractions. And I wonder to myself, just by looking at it, I wonder why are we talking about errors as opposed to infractions? Why is her mishandling of the checks? Why are we all considering that as an error as opposed to an infraction? She went against the company policy, and they warned her, and she knew. So why is that an error as opposed to an infraction?
Justice Gableman, the issue of infractions, I did not understand, was before the court on this particular case. It's also my understanding that...
But I wonder why not.
Well, because we thought, as counsel, I would say, that the clearest way for Ms. Overton to be granted the benefits is is under number two, and all three of those...
That part I understand.
Yeah, all three of those are independent basis if you meet one of them.
I'm concerned about everyone in this case, but I am equally concerned about everyone in every case who's going to be guided by our opinion. So if you can help me out, that's fine, and I would appreciate it. Why, and if you can't, that's fine too. Just say you don't know and we'll move on. Why, I wonder, is this, why is everyone talking about this being an error and not an infraction? How do we distinguish the two? It's an honest question. I don't know.
It is an honest question and a good question. And I have read many of Lurk's decisions in an attempt to understand that better. And I don't have an answer for you.
Okay, thank you.
Well, the term infraction is not defined in the statute, is it?
No, it is not.
The term error is defined in the statute, right? At least as it relates to a DWD error. That's what
yes.
the court
Correct.
Feels
that,
like.
The, Judge Riley did point to that.
Okay.
Pointed to what?
But if that...
A definition of error.
A definition of error.
108.
Did he get it from the dictionary?
No. 108.02.10e.a.m.
Yeah.
Okay.
From the statute.
From the statute. But it relates to a DWD error, and this is not a DWD error.
Correct.
So we have two errors not really defined in this provision. So if you can meet one of these three, you get, your client gets unemployment. That's your position.
That is what the legislature intended.
Well, that's not true completely under one, though. That's not true of infractions, because infractions goes on to say unless an infraction is repeated after the employer warns the employee about the infraction. That's the distinction.
Correct. If I said
when
differently,
you
I
knew. No. Misspoke. You understood it when I was asking you about infractions. I know that.
Well,
but substantial fault doesn't include one or two or three. That's what it says.
Correct.
So if you can show your client fits under two, then she gets benefits.
Correct.
Even if she does not fit under one or three.
Correct.
Okay. That's why you have to pick the one that suits your client, and if you can get within it, fine. And even if you can't, if you don't get under infraction, you still would, if you comply with two, get unemployment benefits. If you fit under two, you get unemployment benefits.
Correct. But in the first instance, Lurk indicated they do the analysis of all three of those, but they did not, we respectfully point out, do the inadvertent errors in the Lila Overton case, although I understand Chief Justice Rogensack's point about that.
And you're looking predominantly at, and I'm looking at the appendix of Mistress of the of Lurk. The paragraph says in the present case, and then is that what we're relying on? Is that their ultimate findings?
I'm sorry,
Are you referring to the third paragraph above the
decision.
Word decision and the last page?
Of the Lurk opinion?
Of
yes.
the Lurk opinion, that of the ALJ's opinion. In the present case, the employer's requirement, it's the same paragraph that you were focusing on
right.
when you were responding to Chief Justice Rogensack.
So I see my red light is on. Thank you for your attention. I appreciate Justice Gableman understanding the facts of my client's situation.
And I appreciate your good argument.
Thank you very much. Rebuttal, please.
We do understand that the statute had protections for employees in the form of the three exclusions, but it is clear that the overall intent of the legislation was to disqualify more employees. And we also believe it was when the legislature takes a definition and codifies it almost word for word with no change in meaning, that the legislature is showing no sign of doing anything but maintaining the definition only in a statutory form, such that the history of interpretation of the definition comes into the statute.
Counsel, I want to pick up where the question left off regarding the analysis of inadvertent error in the administrative law judge's opinion. In looking at the last page of that opinion, the paragraph that follows the statute being set out, the statute on the substantial fault and then setting forth the three exceptions, I find no analysis of inadvertent errors. So if you, after you set forth the statute, so if you could point me to where the administrative law judge did any analysis of inadvertent errors in the conclusion, I would appreciate it.
The administrative law judge did not do a specific analysis of the errors with regard to their inadvertence or non-inadvertence.
Okay, fair enough. No specific analysis. How about any analysis?
All I can say, Your Honor, is what we said with respect to the Gallenberg case.
No, I'm talking about, I'm looking at the opinion. We're reviewing the opinion. Where in the opinion is an analysis of any inadvertent error?
There is no specific analysis on inadvertent error, but as we have indicated, if the court believes that there should have been, the proper recourse is to remand the matter to the commission for further proceedings, not to substitute its own factual findings for those the commission made, or, which is what we believe the Court of Appeals did.
And just so that I'm clear, quite obviously, and you indicate there is no analysis of any specific inadvertent errors, and there is no analysis of inadvertent errors.
That's correct. We came to the conclusion after looking at the failures or errors, and I want to point out that we were calling them errors because Walgreens characterized them as cash handling errors. We don't believe that was any kind of concession that they were automatically inadvertent errors, because if all errors were already inadvertent, then the exclusion would read errors and not inadvertent errors.
Mr. Sample, the reason you've gotten questions about whether these facts are inadvertent errors is because if there's a remand, it's because it's a factual finding and the commission has to do it.
Yes.
If the court should say, we're in this case, you have no disputed facts, there's no dispute that she made 8 mistakes, is there?
Actually, that's at least 10, because there were 2 additional failures that the manager did not
write 10. For the moment, I'll give you 10. Just for the moment. All right. So there's no disputed fact that she made 10 mistakes relating to these kinds of check cashing, right?
Many of them had to do with checks, but not all of them.
Okay. I'll give you that. She made 10 mistakes, okay? There's no dispute that she made these 10 mistakes, all right? The question then becomes whether these 10 mistakes over the 20 months, over thousands of transactions, amount to one or more inadvertent errors made by the employee. That's the statutory language. Isn't that the question?
That is the question.
Okay. The usual rule is where you have undisputed facts and whether they fit a statutory statement, the usual rule is that's a question of law. In addition to that usual rule, the rule is that if the determination involves factual issues, factual inferences, etc., then it's a kind of quasi-fact, quasi-law, and deference is paid to the fact finder. I mean, that's the usual thing. That's why you've been asked these questions. So in light of that statement of what I think is the usual law, we have undisputed facts here. Why can't this court decide that these 10 undisputed facts do or do not constitute inadvertent errors under the statute?
Because...
That's a picture.
I hope so.
Me too.
Whether an act was inadvertent or not is essentially saying the question whether the act was intentional or not.
Right.
And that is a finding of fact. An actor's intent is a finding of fact and not a conclusion of law. And we don't think there's there would be a basis for making a finding that her failures were inadvertent.
Okay, so what you're saying is the administrative law judge here is implicitly saying this is intentional.
Intentional, yes. Not the intent of the misconduct standard, but not unintentional. They were volitional failures. They were just done without the specific deliberate wrongful intent of the misconduct standard.
Okay, thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And thank you both for good arguments. This is a hard case, and it's an area that I've kind of been a lot before I became a judge, and I find it fascinating how we think we know how the law goes, and then, of course, the legislature puts a new wrinkle in it, and here we are, back again. So thank you very much. The briefs were very good, and they were very helpful, and your arguments were quite good as well. We are now going to adjourn. The court will meet again in closed conference at 1:30, and Justice Gableman will be out to chat with those students who can stay a little bit today and hear from him. Thank you.